Good morning, everyone, and welcome to day two of Host City. I hope everyone is fresh for today. I think this is probably one of, from my point of view, representing a host, this is probably one of the most interesting panels, certainly, that I've been looking forward to. And I'm delighted to be joined by, yes, a very prestigious panel, and I'll introduce the panel members, starting with Paul Bush, OBE, who we heard from yesterday, the Director of Events at Visit Scotland. Also delighted to be joined by Petra Sorling, the President of the International Table Tennis Federation and also a member of the IOC. We're also delighted to be joined this morning by Dr. Beatriz Garcia, a member of the Culture and Olympic Heritage Commission at the International Olympic Committee. And we're also joined this morning, making up the panel, by Damien Combredé-Blassel, the Director of Impact and Heritage at the Paris 2024 Organising Committee. So, welcome this morning. Thank you very much, everyone. And you'll all be accustomed now to the model where we're also running a poll question. And the poll question this morning is, what should be the most important strategic priorities for destinations? And there's a number of options in response to that question. So I would ask you all to consider that and, in the usual manner now, submit your answers. So, how are events helping to deliver against priority outcomes for governments and territories? What can events do to promote the strategic priorities of host regions and cities? So a really big question. And if that's all right, I'll maybe start with you, Petra. And I'll maybe come at this from a slightly different angle. One of the things I know that from your work with the International Table Tennis Federation is you've really focused on that issue about how we can create legacies for cities and territories, obviously with reference to table tennis championships, but you've also been working very closely with universities on this issue. So I wondered if you can maybe tell us about that focus on research and evaluation and that partnership with universities and how that relates to this question.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a very big question we have here in the morning. And my experience is that we all know that when we are coming to a city with an event, we like to create some legacy. Otherwise, everything is gone when the event is over. So from my experience, what we did during one of the World Championships, actually in my home country, Sweden, was that we started before the World Championships creating a network with the university. And that ended up being now a 3-year course for everyone to attend from around the world in leadership. But it was there because of the event. So this is the legacy of the event. Now having a standalone education for leaders in sport to attend. And this is coming through this event. And we also made a contract with the university. So for us as an IF, now taking the other hat on, not the Swedish one, it's also a legacy that we can now send coaches from around the world to the university in Sweden to develop. And also we were doing this because we saw a good example from golf. So we took the example from another sport, and of course we reshaped it a little bit. So I want to say that this is possible in all sports to do something similar. So not only going to the traditional event-styled preparation, but also see what you can do around. And for us, this university cooperation also brought knowledge to our sport. Not only for this course now ongoing, it's a 3 to 4 year course, but also in all the education programs that we have. We can go there, there are professors that can help us, so it really added on value for us as a legacy of the event.
Thanks very much, Petra. I just wonder, I find that really interesting, that issue about learning from other sports. And it was golf in that specific example. I just wonder, in terms of the work that's happening in Paris just now, I wonder, in terms of that learning from previous examples, is that something that that is a part of your overall approach to what's happening in Paris just now?
Yes. Hi. Hello, everyone. Thank you for inviting us, me. Quick answer. Yes, we do try to take... We did not invent anything. Everything we do, we found somewhere, and usually in a federation, IF or national. Just two quick examples. First one is international. The 30 minutes of daily physical activity is something recommended by the World Health Organization for kids aged 6 to 17. We are far from it. One boy out of two and two girls out of three, it is very gender biased, do not reach this 60 minutes of daily physical activity. We found in Finland a sports program that's called School on the Move, and we just imported it and tried to adapt it to the French environment. So now every kid in primary school has a 30 minute of daily physical activity program. Second example, what we call sports job dating, you know, job dating without a suit for people who are not that comfortable in a suit, but who can show skills and, you know, team spirit and qualities. Well, rugby did that in the north of France in a very small village. And we not only took that program to make it national, but we showed it to four other federations. And now table tennis and basketball and three others do it. So one good, and I think the games or major events in general have that opportunity to, you know, put light. We have the biggest spotlight in the world. You can use that spotlight, put it on a good initiative and make it different and replicate it with other sports.
I suppose, in a sense, that's one of the key themes of this conference, isn't it? That issue about sharing knowledge, best practice, knowledge transfer. So thanks for that, Damien. And maybe come to you next, Paul. This question, I suppose, is about the strategic landscape. And we've just heard from the minister about the national event strategy that's currently being worked on and hopefully launched in the spring of next year. And indeed, you mentioned it yesterday in your opening remarks. And that question, I suppose, about aligning events and the event pipeline with that national strategy and building in the policy-led initiatives and those values. I wonder maybe in the context of this question whether you can tell us a bit more about how you're approaching that question in terms of the development of the national strategy.
Good morning. I was interested to hear that the strategy might be launched in March, April, May or June. So that's one for my colleagues over there in the team to pick up afterwards. I think there's three really simple things in terms of measurement now. And I think we're at a bit of a crossroads in terms of the events industry globally. And we're all grappling with the same challenges. And I think probably coming together will be quite both important but also necessary. Traditionally, everyone in this room has measured events through economic impact and media profile. For me, that probably won't change. And I think for the big ticket global mega events, that will still sit in a bucket, as it will with some of the big cultural things like MTV, etc. You will always have to do that, probably to get the business case through government and in a UK sense through the Green Book. However, there is an emerging aspect for me which I don't think collectively we do very well. Certainly in Scotland we don't. And I think it's something you'll see come much higher in the strategy when we launch it in the spring. Two things. First thing is, how do we measure the greater benefits of events? And I think we're going to talk much more about that this morning. And I won't go into the specific details, but you all know those matrix, you know, the social community, disadvantaged groups, young people, women, etc., etc. We don't have tools currently to clearly measure those successfully and then actually demonstrate that the event has actually had positive impact in those areas. But the third area, which I think we do very, very poorly at present collectively, unless somebody in this room does this, and if you do, that would be great to have a chat, is articulate the benefits that are much softer. So it's quite interesting. Our minister came to a golf event in the summer, the Genesis Scottish Open, and we didn't talk to her about golf. We actually talked to her about the impacts outside of golf. And the greatest example was waste food from hospitality units and vendors went to food banks at the end of every day. Now, she got really excited about that because that's an absolute positive aspect that events can do. Every event in the world could do that. Now, I know you're going to say that some events do that already, but we've got to do that in a much more cohesive and structured fashion and then actually articulate that to politicians to say, actually, we are hitting all of your political ambitions, but also all of the country's ambitions in terms of the social and the community impacts of those events. So, you know, you've probably heard me talk about it before. We need to turn the model on its head. Impact and profile will sit at the bottom, and the other things will sit at the top, and I think we'll see a much different funding landscape for events moving forward.
Thanks, Paul. I think that's a really important issue because I think at both a metropolitan and a national level, that, if you like, rebalancing of requirements around events and what the priorities are is becoming increasingly marked, and that focus on more qualitative measures is becoming really significant and presents a real challenge. Yes, Damien, please.
Really quickly, but the subject is really very important. Two remarks. First, I fully agree with you. I think one thing can be improved. It is what we promise and what we expect. I usually say it's not Christmas, you know. Let's stop expect too much. And we can be better in agreeing on how do we measure it. The inputs, I mean, how much money and energy and effort do I put in it? The outputs, what is out of it? We distributed a sports kit to every school who does 30 minutes of daily physical activity. Okay, that's an output. But what about the outcome? And that needs years of research. I mean, the change, the transformational change of kids doing 30 minutes of daily physical activity will be measured in 30 or 40 years. That's why we need research.
And I think, you know, and again, don't take this as a criticism to any project managers in the room, but quite a lot of us in this room sat through the UCI Cycling World Championships and we saw lots of action plans, often with 33, 35, 46 targets. And I said, let's just do three, but let's do three really well, because I think that's one of the you know, traps that we all fall into. And actually, we then don't deliver anything.
If I can,
please.
Is this working? Yes, because yes, it's a really important topic. It has been the focus of my work also for the last 23 years in terms of approaches to measurement. And I think the key, certainly the longitudinal angle, I mean, this is getting more and more accepted on how you need to revisit things, you know, 5-10 years later. But the other element is that beyond the assessment of impact and outcomes, it's also documenting the process. I think we are getting better at that. We were discussing yesterday around knowledge transfer mechanisms and how do you go beyond the manual. But the truth is that what do we do with all of this information that we accumulate? Because we have mountains of data. I mean, data is not lacking. The problem is how we interpret it and how much perspective do we take to actually make sense of it. And certainly looking into those soft factors. And on the soft factor side of things, I do believe the discussion around process, strategic thinking, memory and how it evolves, you know, and how networks have changed over time or what has inspired people. It's getting better. So I believe there is, and also really important, the case studies and the reference are becoming very diverse. And in the sports world or on the events world, what matters is also to make sure you are not only looking to your immediate peers. So I do believe it's an area that is getting better and better. And certainly in the UK, we have maybe 30 years of accumulated knowledge. Internationally, probably the last 15 are getting much more sophisticated.
One sentence. Yeah, please, Damien, no? Let's keep it conversational.
I fully agree with you. And we all heard how complex it is, what you just mentioned. That's why it's a research job. But we need to measure the gap between the complexity and the time that it takes to explore what you just mentioned and people and media expecting on July 26th. So, what's your impact? What's your legacy? And the answer you just gave is hard to accept for people who expect key figures, key, you know, messages, and filling that gap will be a challenge.
This is a huge issue, and I'm hoping that there'll be some really interesting contributions from the floor when we come around to the point where we're asking for interventions from the floor. I know that there are people in the audience who've been working on this issue and this question as well, possibly not for quite as long as Beatrice, but I know, for instance, that the International Association of Event Hosts have done a lot of work on measurement and evaluation and that question about quantitative versus qualitative measures. And that whole issue about case studies and telling stories about events as well as the hard facts is a really, really interesting set of developments. So we will hopefully come back to that. And just following on, Beatrice, from your comments there, I know that one of the areas that you have been focusing on is the issue about, authenticity, to call it that, the issue about making sure the events are not just about blowing dust off a manual and moving the event from one territory, one host to the next, but about making sure the events recognise and reflect the characteristics of local territories, local hosts, that it is about placemaking, that it is about authenticity. So can you maybe tell us a bit more about that and why that is important and how it, if in a sense, feeds back into that conversation about evaluation and legacy?
Yes, thank you. Yes, it's a really important topic. It's the ongoing discussion between, if we talk about knowledge transfer and best practice, how on the one hand, how do you balance the tension between the global models and the way that an umbrella organization, let's say the IOC, might have developed an idea around how to be most efficient in how you deliver your event and how the host city should function when you become an Olympic city, for instance, vis-a-vis the importance to connect always with a place and a time, no? So the local factors, the unique, the distinctive approaches that in every host city might occur, and that might be very different or might have a different departing point from the previous one. I think this is a really important point, especially if we consider on the strategic, you know, the forward-thinking priorities for localities. One area that I have been observing is what is called the look and feel. So the program, what is called the look of the games, for instance, and it's the way you dress your city. It's something that has... It's really relevant because it helps you navigate your city and it's how you go from A to B and how you generate this sense of the festival, no? The kind of unique and distinct moment that is the kind of one-off, the memorable time. In the last 15 to 20 years, I believe this is an area that has changed from being an opportunity to express distinctiveness into actually potentially transforming your city in an airport, no, in a non-place. So a really, really efficient place that looks like any other Olympic city and makes it very easy for the delegations, for the media to understand where everything is, but where you might forget where you are. So I do believe it's maybe an area that needs to be recovered in some way and to remember the possibilities that exist when you do something that can be very efficient, but at the same time, memorable. And one example is, for instance, what Mexico did in 1968. No, it is still a best practice example. If you think of Mexico and the graphic design, you know, the approach to dressing that city, it was really innovative at the time. I think it has remains unsurpassed as an addition that managed to transform and advance approaches, for instance, the way the metro functioned. I mean, it's a legacy to this day, how the navigation of the metro system in Mexico was developed. It was done because of an Olympic Games in order to make it easy to know where things were, but at the same time was distinct to that time. In more recent years, the approach to color codes, the approach to, you know, the watermarks and so on are becoming quite standardized. And I think it's an area that is worth debating. So obviously I say this, I mean, my role with the IOC is to advise them in terms of cultural policy and cultural strategy approaches. And I think it's a really interesting area for debate. Obviously Barcelona was the other example, no? It was the example of a city that wanted to be a protagonist and wanted to steal the picture, no? Mm-hmm. So how to use and how to also plan how your venues are located so that you have a connection, a reference to a skyline, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm bringing up the discussion. In terms of how you capture that and its impact, I do believe there is much that we need to do on how we dress event cities so that, again, on the one hand, they are efficient, but on the other, they leave room for these very unique marks that should allow you to always remember, well, you are in London, you are in Paris, and it could not be anywhere else.
Well, I suppose that the next place to go after that, really, Damien, is you. If we're talking about global event models, then they don't come much bigger than the Olympics. So I suppose two things to maybe ask you, Damien. I mean, the first thing I suppose I have to ask is, building on what Beatrice has said, it'd be interesting to hear to what extent Paris is thinking about how Paris emerges from underneath the Olympic template mm-hmm. and actually presents its characteristics and its identity. But also then, I suppose, what are the strategic aspirations of Paris around the Olympics? With maybe, because I know, for instance, if thinking about Glasgow, not that we're quite at an Olympic level, health and well-being, sport and physical activity, getting people active and participating and dealing with some of the health issues would be a major strategic objective from our point of view. And I know from what I know about Paris that that's one of your key objectives. So maybe useful to talk about how you're approaching that and how you're utilising, leveraging the Olympics to make real inroads into those issues. So two issues there, Damien.
Thanks, and happily we have 3 hours and a half between us before us, so that will be useful. Just a quick reaction to what Beatrice said. I think it's obviously super important, and I discovered something. It's also about participation. I was working with the city of Paris, of course, the host city. We work very closely together. And we refurbish basketball fields in town, and also handball and others, and with the look of the games, and with women faces, role models, so that young teenagers, the moment they usually drop sport, feel connected to that field, and they feel, you know, they own the place, and they feel legitimate there. And we had the funding, we had the design, we had the artist, and it took weeks and weeks, and it was like, guys, what are you doing? You know, we're kind of on a clock here. And it took months, and I didn't understand. And they finally explained to me, they said, Damien, this is not that simple. You can't just bring your portrait of a woman that people don't know in the neighborhood and just paint it. It won't work. And they took weeks asking people, what woman should it be? And they found a young basketball player of the neighborhood of Paris North, very popular neighborhood, and it's her portrait. And the neighborhood loves the field, and women come and play much more than they would have. And that was, for me, a real learning. Then a word about Paris, and how do you show Paris? Well, we're lucky enough to have a model, and the IOC was super open about that, where 95% of our venues are existing, are temporary, using our most iconic venues. Tour Eiffel, the River Seine, and the bridges, Chateau de Versailles, Grand Palais. I mean, this is our city. You see it. It's the building. So we hope to showcase the games in our most iconic venues. I think it's good for the sports that will be, you know, showcased in very beautiful places. It's also good for our iconic monuments and city. And finally, to answer your second question, people expected so much. We spent a year going from places, community to community, asking what should it be for you. And it was Christmas before beforehand. And we knew that we couldn't manage these expectations. And bottom line, sports, physical activity, was the one thing where we felt legitimate. We felt we could have an action. We could mobilize the sports movement and companies and cities and schools, all the stakeholders around us. We could, you know, put people around the same table and say, let's try to move on that issue. Very critical health issue. We are sitting all day. More than 2 or 3 hours a day is dangerous. So please stand up every moment you want during our speech and afterwards. We do not measure how sitting all day, being sedentary behaviors and physical activity, which are two different things, are killing us. Don't stop me on that. But yeah, this was the issue that, and we have a luck, you know, I've worked in various places, and copyright infringement on the internet, my address was the most hated one in the whole French net paysage. And now I have an email address that says paris2024.org by the end of it. My mails are opened fast and get a positive answer. It's because it's the games. And we have every layer, you know, in France we call it le millefeuille administratif, like the pastry, because we have arrondissement, ville, département, établissement public territorial, région, préfecture. They're all for different political sides. They all come around the table. And so do our sponsor companies, and so does the Ministry for National Education, which is known to be hard to shake. And we managed to have transformational changes using active design in the buildings, in the public space, in the workplace, in schoolyards, where girls are generally in the remote areas of the schoolyards, where you can change that if you change the schoolyards. And we decided to have one objective, not 170, and try to move that school, cities, and workplaces. And that is a way to change Paris that I think is, well, ambitious but necessary.
Do you want to come in, Paul?
Just quickly, I think Beatrice makes a really interesting point about look and feel. We have spent millions and millions of pounds and dollars on look and feel. Has it made an impact and a difference? And I saw a great example 3 weeks ago in Paris. I went to the fan zone for the Rugby World Cup. And the best example I've ever seen, because I'm a bit of an event anorak, I would see this. You stood in the fan zone and you had the Place de la Concorde and the Eiffel Tower as your picture. There was no branding. You didn't need any branding. And that, to me, I think is really important now, that we grasp the locality and showcase that.
Thanks, Paul. A couple of themes there. One is about the management of expectations, not promising Christmas, as you say, Damien, although Christmas is quite close now. And another about the tools that we use to build participation and build engagement. And maybe coming back to you, Petra, because one of the other areas that I know that you've been looking at is, and we talked about this yesterday, is the impact of technology. If we're not careful, technology, in a sense, could be a force against participation and against engagement. People just sitting at screens. So how can we work with technology to ensure that we still maintain and enhance participation and engagement and activity?
Yeah, I mean, I think very much was said here, because it's so exciting to listen what we are expecting in Paris is actually when we say sustainability and sharing is caring, I think it will be proved in Paris. And also the example from what you saw from the fan zone and the Eiffel Tower behind. Because we have to use what we have instead of exactly what you said, like the airport example. So I can really feel that what was said is really building on to my answer in how tech can also be something that we can see as an advantage instead of something that is working against us. Because we are not, as sport, and from the sports movement, we are not competing other sport. I mean, I am not, as a table tennis president, competing other sports. I see that the competition we have for the future is more in getting people active. TikTok is a competitor to sport. And then we are going into health and how to activate the people, because we need to activate people if we want to attract them as spectator to the events. So that is my twist on this. So what Paris is doing now is super, because by activating in the areas, like this is urban planning for me more than anything else, and this is actually my profession. So I see here how my life goes together, sport and urban planning, and how we create a city and a good value for the citizens. Because if they are active, they are also more keen to go and watch. And if the games in Paris, if everyone is out running there, if everyone is part of the opening ceremony, they're also more keen to follow. And they're also more keen afterwards to stay active. And that will also be very good for the city and to activate the citizens. So that's health. So here I can link it together that without health, without tech, we are in problem. But to use it in a positive way and also use it, for example, to make activities through technology, make it available for everyone, and also not to be, and I loved your example that not always use the big stars, use the local ones, and use the local backdrop. With not everyone have the Eiffel Tower, but we have something. So I really see how this merges together, and I see tech as an opportunity, but we have to also realize that it's the real people we need to have as active and as the spectators, and to make them come is actually, for me, the recipe is to make them active. And then we win on the health side as well.
Really interesting the way in which that brought together a number of themes that we've already spoken about, that issue about locality and authenticity, that issue about urban planning, that issue about technology. And Beatrice, I think you want to come in, is that right?
Yes, because the point here, I believe there is ample evidence to demonstrate that in terms of real long-term impact and legacy, these kind of thinking processes, so the time that you take to really approach something in a meaningful way, it gives results. But how do you justify it? Again, when we are always running out of time, I mean, the approach of the opening ceremony in Paris is going to be so complex to organize. And we want to believe that it's worthwhile and it's the right approach, because obviously the ambition, the reason to do it that way is really positive. We will see in terms of the judgment, no? Because obviously it's very time consuming. It's a really, really, really slow process, no? So how do you document and this story that you were saying about the choice of faces, so that you explain that actually this is what will matter when you think in 5, in 10, in 20 years' time, no? If you really want this to be something that is owned by the communities, is the only way to do it. So obviously my question also, and what I keep thinking out loud is, how do you keep explaining that when you have these efficiencies, no, and this pressure, okay, budgets keep getting cut, how do we compete, you know, with other agendas? We need to deliver and we need to demonstrate, you know, value for money. How do you justify the fact that actually, yes, engaging with the local backdrop, using iconic venues that will be so much harder to operate rather than just getting your classic bubble, no, of the, you know, the park and the ready-made space, you know, how do you keep making sure that you explain that it just makes a difference to take this other approach, no, that is a bit more difficult. Yes.
Paul?
I think we need to break the funding model in simple terms. Everyone probably in this room operates in a traditional funding model. So as Event Scotland, we get our money from the minister. We get it from one portfolio. There are many, many portfolios in government, and that's what we need to tap into to change the model. So we've got to break the model. That'll be quite hard, be quite challenging, but we have to demonstrate that the value sits in that 360-degree wheel.
I do want to leave time for questions from the floor, but given that we have Damien with us and given that the Olympics will be in Paris next year, I've maybe just got I'll ask Damien the final question, really. And given the massive commitment, the massive investment that an Olympic Games requires, you have to assume that that is justified on the basis of transformational change, the expectation that this will result in transformational change in Paris. So can you give us a flavour of what, from the point of view of the organisers, from the point of view of the city, what that transformational change expectation, aspiration, ambition, what that transformational change ambition is for Paris?
another 3 hours ahead of us. It's a really hard question. The ecological transformation of Paris is at the heart of the ambition since the bid. It is a very strong commitment, political commitment of the mayor of Paris, who was the mayor during the bid and who's still the mayor. So eliminating diesel, thank you, as soon as 2024. Eliminating as much as possible single-use plastic as soon as 2024. Basically, accelerating things that everyone said, okay, let's say 2036. You know, and you know how things go. Putting pressure on creating a deadline. That's what the catalyst is about. It's about the deadline that you can't push. And having a political will saying, well, this deadline will be used to deliver the games, but also to do these and that transformation. The transformation of the River Seine is, of course, the most ambitious example. It requires all the millefeuille, you know, because the Seine does not stop at the boundary of the city. It's a river. So you need the state, you need the département before and the one after. You need everyone committing for one single use. And the games have that power to want everyone to succeed, which is not always the case in French politics. So using that to transform that city in that field of ecological change and resilience to climate change is the first, I think, one key achievement that the host city wants to achieve. The second one is using physical activity and sports, and I use the word on purpose, to create a city that is more inclusive for people, for elderly people, for people with a hip accident, for people with a trolley or a baby, for anyone. I mean, this is what physical activity can do, and this is why what you just said is so important. It's not the sports direction or the sports ministry that needs to be aware of our impact. It's urban planning, it's social cohesion, it's elderly health, because what physical, thinking our city as a place where people can move, it's not just for 30 to 40, upper class white male. It's something that does change the life of everyone. And this is something that in France we haven't thought about. I think sport can be exported in every direction, every ministry, and it does, the social impact and the financial impact is more and more measured in time. So I think, yeah, ecological transformation and also offering the possibility to move on a daily basis, including for people with a disability, for example, not just physical, but also mental, etc., is something that a city can do. And just to finish, about disability, for example, there are things we cannot do with the games, or it would have taken way longer and way more money. Transforming the metro is something too deep, too profound, too long, it's too big of an investment in such an old city with an old metro such as Paris to be reasonable. But creating entire neighborhood where someone with a disability, no matter what the disability is, visible or invisible, can move feeling secure and safe and included in the city and also practice is something that is achievable. So I think, again, about setting expectations, this is where the host city is expecting a lot. Physical transformation, ecological transformation, this is hard to say in English, and sport for inclusion, basically.
Thanks very much, Damien. Very good response. So we only have about 5 minutes left, but I've been reliably informed that if we have to run over, that's absolutely fine. So we've covered a lot of ground there, some really big issues, measurement, evaluation, how we actually tell stories about events, research, the whole issue about what can events do for a host, for a territory. What about authenticity and the characteristics of local hosts? So I'm expecting a flurry of hands to go up. So
are people standing up? You know.
Oh, there you go. So I'll open it up now to questions from the floor.
Does feel good.
There's Mike here.
Mike Laughlin, Global Sustainable Sport. Wonderful panel. Fantastic. Actually, really, really interesting. I think you've got so many thoughts of where the industry is going. I find it really interesting, the voting up there, because you've got the word sustainability at the bottom. Because I wonder if people really understand what that means. Because to me, sustainability sits and incorporates all of those things. It's not a separate entity, it's actually part of them all. And I think that coming back to what you were saying, Paul, about kind of reimagining what we do as an industry, we're doing a lot of work in that space at the moment. And I think it's interesting to see how we can kind of redefine our industry to think about sustainability as part of our DNA and our core, rather than being something that's kind of an adjunct, which I don't think people really understand that well. So I'd be really interested to get your feel. How do we do that? I think a lot of sports industries are thinking about all these areas, but it's kind of all part of one big umbrella.
So I think the value proposition is critical. And everything we've talked about this morning is the value proposition. Whether we like it or not, the industry we live in lives within a tourism ecosystem. And I think, sadly, governments don't value tourism and events as valuable to the economy as much as we do in this room. And I think that's the challenge we all face, which is the unlocking tool to money. And as soon as that penny drops, I mean, lots of politicians, I'd say if Christina was in the room, they make wise comments and warm comments about events and tourism, but they actually don't always put the money where their mouth is. And actually, I think we've got to be quite brave as an industry and actually say the value proposition across all of these areas and all the great comments we've had this morning is far greater than the sum of the parts and actually far greater than lots of other things that contribute to the national economy.
I think you said it very well with the fact that there are other stakeholders you should be talking to, because sport delivers a much broader impact than just tourism, you know. But as you say, we've traditionally looked at economic as the tool, but actually we've got so many more assets there. So thank you.
I wonder if any other panel members want to comment on that.
Thank you for the question, because I think that sustainability is everything. And also, as I said, nothing we can choose. I mean, it's the only way forward. But I think that sustainability was everything that we spoke about here in the panel. People, planet, prosperity. Because people, we took the good examples from both Barcelona and Mexico and also Paris upcoming. But also when it comes to reuse what we have in terms of facilities, venues, it's also for the planet. But prosperity, we have to find the sources of money in different channels. And I think that is why when we are looking at our events now in 2024, trying to see how we can, from what we are doing, we have, for example, in table tennis, we have world championships for people with Parkinson. And that is one of those occasions. Of course, this is not, we cannot help to get free from this terrible disease, but we can help with quality of life as a sport. And with that, of course, that is health. And when we work with the association, we had a health week in Greece, they went to the Minister of Health instead of the Minister of Sport. And this we can do. This we did because it was Parkinson. But this we can do with everything, because to stand up, that is also health. So I think that the people, the planet, and prosperity, as for me, is the definition of sustainability. It's what we are talking about, and we have to be better in communicating it and to make also the cities and government, etc., to understand this benefit so that we can also get more support. I think in this group, in this room, we can all agree. But it's very, very important for us how to communicate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Petra.
I mean, just building on that, this city has a great football memory scheme, mm-hmm. which is tackling dementia. Now, you would never believe that sport and that would fit together. The same way around golf in terms of health, walking golf courses. So there's some classic things in our hands we just need to activate and probably be a bit braver.
Beatrice?
Yes, just a comment in terms of how I read this, obviously these kind of polls. And what I have realized is that obviously they are not mutually exclusive. And that what we see is obviously sustainability is the catchphrase for all, whilst the other three give you a choice in terms of what are the tools you can use for that sustainable future. So what is interesting here is how, taking the temperature of the room, what we see is more and more weight being given to the social and health-related impacts, health-related aspects, and also the cultural dimensions, as opposed to just the pure economic drivers as the motor for sustainability, which takes us back to your first point on the need for more soft measures. Because we have spent probably 20 years very much focused on making the economic case, which was necessary, you know, to demonstrate that sport, that arts and culture can have an economic impact. But that has been largely explored, and what we need now is these other much broader agendas. And our problem is that, again, we don't have sufficient grasp on the sound bites, no? How to present those facts in a way that are not questionable, when obviously the demand is far more on that front. And obviously, yes, instead of sustainability, we could have asked the ecological angle, no? Because that's the one where we could have, you know, the social, health, cultural, ecological. So it's the way I read these responses, probably.
Thank you. Thanks for the question, Mike. So who has the next question or comment or observation?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Kevin. I work for Event Flanders. We attract major events to Flanders, which is a northern part of Belgium, not just a character in The Simpsons. Thank you for the panel. I've got a question probably for Damien and Beatrice, mostly. You talked about the importance of documenting the process. I think that's a very interesting point. We recently had the World Championships breaking, which is a discipline also in Paris at the Olympics. And for the first time, we kind of did a whole very intense legacy track, where we kind of got all the different stakeholders together and mapped out a theory of change for that specific event, where, you know, most of the time stakeholders have their own ambitions when they're involved with an event. And here we took a deliberate step of bringing all of those different ambitions together and creating a common theory of change. So we had like common ambitions, common outcomes that we were all working towards together. That was a kind of like a common responsibility as well. So just wondering about that process, because it was very time-consuming for us, very intense. So if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more about how that process takes place when it's in regarding to the Olympics and how that works, because that's not very clear to me at this stage.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because what we have is a lot of the know-how that simply is discussed verbally, no? So, I mean, I think there are still not sufficiently good examples of how you share your experience with process. We are talking a lot on getting teams to keep like diaries, in terms of a diary, in terms of those little achievements on how your objectives or your understanding of your objectives evolve. And also the documenting of the barriers, no? So in terms of being able to explain how there are certain aspects that do take much longer, and this should not be seen just an example of failure. It's not really necessarily a flaw. It's just that things have emerged that have forced you to operate, not to be more demanding than you originally expected. So yes, with the documenting and the explanation on process, we are currently working on how you report on that. How can you present the cycle on decision making? So there is a lot of work on the modeling and how your strategic goals might evolve. How important, obviously, is when you depart to have a sense of what success looks like, but actually then to account for the unexpected, not to say, well, actually we tried this, but then we might have had to make this or that change, and that explains this delay. I'm very glad to hear that you are working with theory of change, and we have been also testing, again, the idea that when you are trying to assess impact, that things are not lineal, but that also more like circular, no? So there is also a way, in terms of how you understand the change that you produce, that there is not just a beginning and an end. No, it's, and sometimes what you are doing is just reverting back into informing your next range. I don't know with Paris how you are playing with that.
Yeah,
no?
Go and explain that in a tweet, you know. I fully agree with Beatrice about our experience. It's a real challenge. We have created an open platform where every program supported by the games, by us, we have an endowment fund where we fund small community projects. We have more than 1,000 all across France, so we can't monitor them all, and let's not even think about evaluate them all. But we can at least get the data so research can have access to it. So we created that open platform where everyone who wants to be part of, well, it's on a voluntary basis, but can have that. Then we need, I think, a common framework. OECD and French national, AFD, National Agence Française de Développement, so French National Agency for Development, and other actors have been working with the IOC to create a common framework of how does sport projects contribute to the SDGs. This was very needed because everyone had its own, you know, black box where, we had no chance to be convincing if it was a black box of private, you know, in like a private secret industriel. Like, this is my impact, but I won't tell you how I got it. This cannot work. So this common framework is very useful. Then you need the toolbox. A small project, even with the framework, I mean, theory of change is, as you said, quite challenging, quite time-consuming. We have so many volunteers who struggled to keep their club alive, you know, asking them to measure the impact of their small impact through sport project is asking a lot. So we tried to create a toolbox. It's open, and you can Google it, accompagnement.impact2024.org, with resources and help to how do I start, you know, how what question, evaluative question do I ask, and what indicators do I set, and how do I get data, and how do I analyze data, and how do I interpret and exploit it. So we try to do that. And bottom line, the final challenge is who wants to listen. Because, and I haven't found the answer. I think researchers want to listen. Communities want to listen. I think we have a lot to do and to be bold, or ambitious, or courageous, as brave, as you said, to go also to our leaders and opinion leaders and media and say, no, Kylian Mbappé is not in that club. And no ministry will do the inauguration. But you know what? It's interesting no matter what, because they change something. But convincing media to and everyone to pay attention, I think, is the last challenge all along the way.
Thank you, and thanks for that question. Any more questions? I think we have one right up there. Quick question.
And where is the box? Where is the soft box?
Oh, yeah. The catch box.
So this will be the last question, I think.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name's Orso Porta. I work at Paris 2024 as well. As head of event services. But firstly, thanks for all the opinions you just shared now. Keeping in mind that sustainability is always a strategic goal across different events, doesn't matter if it's Paris 2024 or a city's vision, to deliver on all of the initiatives in all of the organizing committees that I've been a part of, there's always an educational piece for staff. But the closer we get to events, we often find that the priority becomes delivery. But how can future organizers enhance that delivery of the sustainable objectives that organizers and other stakeholders have for their event?
Thanks, Orso. Big question. If we I'll start with you, Paul, but if we can maybe keep our answers brief.
That is a great question, and it's something we're grappling with in Scotland, and we're analysing what we did in cycling. And I think to this day, the greatest example in the world is still in Vancouver, the work that Bruce Dewar does. He's spoken at our conference previously, and it's linked to philanthropy as well. So it does do that 360-degree work. I'm sure Paris has looked at the work they do in Vancouver. It's Lift Philanthropy Now, I think the name of the company is, and that's in its 13th year. So the fact that it's had that longevity means it's working. But I think that's the only example in the world I can think of that has been really successful.
Yeah, sure, Tim.
I've spoken too much already, sorry. But first, put it in writing from the beginning, hopefully in a contract. And second, succeed. Try early and succeed. One example, the Olympic and Paralympic Week is something we created during the bid phase. It's become so successful that even now that all the pressure is on delivery, no one will even consider not doing the Olympic and Paralympic Week in the first week of April.
I completely agree with you on that one. I'm already volunteering for that.
Success.
Also, please, a comment from an IOC perspective. This is where we have to work even harder, because it's very clear that it's hard work to prepare for games. And then, of course, when one is finished, you go to the next one. But here, how can we get everything possible out of the games that we are leaving and to make that legacy for the next one? And that is when you're saying about the contract, of course, to take from one to another. It's not easy, but this is where we really have to focus and work even harder. And I think we can do that also in other events. It's not only in the Olympic Games. Also be better and then to evaluate and to bring the knowledge to the next one. That's a very good point.
Well, look, thank you very much for those questions. I'd like to thank Paul, Petra, Beatrice, and Damien for their contributions this morning, and thank you. That's us.
Thank you, Billy.